UK Wine Show, show number 106. Martin Falk on Three Choirs. On this week's show, we cast a spotlight into wine pricing, Three Choirs Vineyard in Gloucestershire, and on England's 2007 vintage. And what is it like growing grapes in a glasshouse?
The idea is that at key times of the year, when they need a little bit of help, either for flowering time or ripening at the end of the season.
And in the news, RAP initiatives benefit the environment, and France shines at the International Wine Challenge.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 106 for the 23rd of May 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Martin Falk. He's the winemaker at Three Choirs. Martin has been making wines in Gloucestershire, England for 20 years, and we talked to him about growing on sandy soils, the 2007 vintage, which has just been released, and why Gloucestershire is such a great place to grow grapes. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. CO2 emissions have been cut by over 28,000 tonnes a year. That's equivalent to taking more than 8,500 cars off the road as a result of RAP's Glassright Wine Initiative. The reduction in emissions has been achieved through bulk importing of wine and also the use of lighter bottles by those involved in the project, which is funded by the Waste and Resources Action Programme, or RAP. Glass bottles now being filled with bulk imported wine in the UK have increased by 79 million to 199 million as a result of the project, and to date more than 350 wines have been lightweighted. According to RAP, the project has helped kickstart a major change in the wine industry. In the past 2 years, lighter weight bottles have become a more regular feature on UK supermarket shelves. And in addition, bulk importing is becoming a more mainstream alternative to bottling at source. The companies involved in the first phase of Glassright Wine include retailers such as Asda, Tesco, the Co-op and Morrisons, and producers and brand owners such as Constellation Europe, which has managed to reduce the carbon footprint of its Echo Falls and Stowell's wines as a result of the project. Plans for the future include looking at the feasibility of lighter weight champagne and sparkling wine bottles. At the moment, champagne bottles are among the heaviest, weighing on average 900 grams, making them almost 400 grams heavier than an average still wine bottle. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I think glass bottle weight is an important issue, and it's good that RAP are leading the way in reducing bottle weights. There has to come a point where the glass is just too light, and then the question needs to be considered, what's next? And what's next may kill off any debate about screw caps versus cork. It could just be Tetra Pak. Banrock Station, for example, have been using Tetra Pak for a while, and while there's some obvious problems with them, their environmental credentials appear to be sound. I have an interview with Tony Shirley, General Manager at Banrock Station, on Tetra Paks, which we're going to release later on in the year. Jane, we covered the IWC challenge this year. What do the results look like?
Well, this year, Chris, France has come top of the medal table at this year's International Wine Challenge, picking up 696 medals in the world's biggest blind tasting competition. France also took the most golds, with 60 of its wines being awarded this highest medal. Australia was second, achieving 587 medals overall, including 48 golds, while Spain and Portugal came third, Spain for total medals of 381, and Portugal for 30 golds. More than 40,000 bottles were assessed for the competition this year, judged by over 370 winemakers, merchants and writers from around the world. In total, there were 267 gold medal winners, over 1,200 silver medals and 2,140 bronze medals. Trophy winners picked from the top medal-winning wines will be announced next month. And England's growing reputation as a wine-producing nation was confirmed by winning 22 medals, most of which awarded for sparkling wines. Three of these went to Ridgeview Wine Estate for its 2005 Merrett Bloomsbury, Merrett Cavendish and Merrett Fitzrovia Rosé. Two went to Knightimber for its Blanc de Noir, Pinot Meunier and Premier Cuvée Blanc de Blanc. And the remaining one went to Camel Valley for its Cornwall White Pinot 2005.
Camel Valley have got some great wines, and their Bacchus and Rosa, I think, are probably the best available in the UK at the moment. Knightimber's wines are coming back into good form. For a while, I keep getting random bottles that made the wine taste very Marmite-y and not very pleasant at all. But they seem to have come back from that, and it may have just been a bad batch, I'm not sure. I've been tasting Nye Timber against the likes of Bollinger and 1999 Dom Perignon last week. And while the Dom is clearly a better wine, at over 100 quid a bottle, you'd expect it to be. But with Nye Timber's big, heavy, yeasty, bready nose, it holds up well against Bollinger. And when you look at the price of Bollinger, it's a bargain. Didn't Nye Timber do well in the International Wine Spirit Competition Awards that were released last week, Jane?
Yes, this week the International Wine and Spirit Competition announced awards for Northern Hemisphere wines. And France topped the charts again with the highest number of awards with 524 and the highest number of golds. Spain came second with 442 medals, just ahead of Portugal for its ports and wines. And for England, Nye Timber did do well. 96% of English wines were awarded medals, with Nye Timber taking the limelight for entries from the UK by picking up a gold best in class for its classic cuvée 2001. A further 8 English sparkling wines got silver best in class medals, including 4 for Chapel Down and a pair each for Nye Timber and Ridgeview. In this competition, over 3,000 light and fortified wines from Europe, Asia, the USA and Canada were judged. Results of the Southern Hemisphere wines will be announced later this summer. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get more detail on these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I've had a very busy week this week with lots of wine tastings, but I've been running a lot of sparkling wine tastings, as I mentioned earlier, and I got to taste Nye Timber up against some very good champagne. And yes, English wines do stack up well. The top champagnes are still better. But the UK are at least now in the same field as the Champagne, and the best of the UK are certainly better than the worst of Champagne. But it isn't just that I've been flat out working on tastings. I've been doing a bit of radio work. We've teamed up with Hardy's to produce a new type of wine tasting. It's a sip-along production. What that means, it's a short theatrical production following the life of two people, a Mr. Normal and a Mrs. Wine Buff. And Mr. Normal tries to blag his way through a blind date with Mrs. Winebuff after telling her a porker about being a wine expert. It's a good, funny show, and with information on how to deal with all those common wine dilemmas, such as buying wine, serving wine, and getting the most out of your wine waiter. As part of the work, Hardy's had commissioned some research and found many people don't know much about wine. For example, of 10% of the 1,000 people polled thought that a sommelier was a pig farmer. This may sound bad, but apparently Scotland has 30% more self-confessed wine experts than England. But 10% of all Scottish people think that sparkling wine is made by putting a small gas canister to give the wine some sparkle. I've had a look at the questions, and the survey was designed to come up with some interesting answers, but it does show that there's a big lack of knowledge out there. And if you're listening to the show, you probably know quite a bit about wine. But if you do want to come along to the sip-along production, it's going to be in London, Bristol, Leeds and Manchester. We're going to be giving a pair of tickets away in our next newsletter that's going out in June. So if you live near Bristol, Manchester, Leeds or London and fancy coming along to the show, do make sure you receive the newsletter. The easiest way to do that is to go to the 3050.co.uk website. In the top right-hand side, you'll see a button saying Contact Us. Select newsletter only and fill in the query form, and you'll be getting our newsletter from then on in. The other thing I've been really busy on in the last couple of weeks is Australia. We're gearing up to expand 3050's wine tastings into Australia this year, and we've just started looking for people to run our tastings. So, if you live in Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne or Perth, and like the idea of a part-time job, you can go to 3050.co.uk and select Join Us on the links on the left-hand side of the homepage. As you can see, with the new theatrical production, Australia, and loads of tasting this week, I've been run off my feet. But I still managed to get this week's spotlight all set up for us. And this week is part two, and we're looking at how does the price of a bottle of wine break down? So this week's spotlight on wine pricing. The costs associated with making a bottle of wine can vary enormously and have a profound effect on how the wine will behave once bottled and ultimately drunk. Let's start by looking at a typical cost of a bottle of wine from Australia to see where the money's spent. In the UK, the duty is £1.46, that's the 2008 duty, and that's consistent irrespective of the value of the wine. On top of that, you have to pay VAT, which is 17.5% of the total value of the wine. So on a £4 bottle of wine, you pay £2.16 in duty and VAT. If you assume shipping cost on a bottle of wine is around 20p, and the supermarkets and most retailers take around 30% markup on wine. Often supermarkets will take a slightly bigger markup and small independents take a slightly smaller markup, but with their buying power, it all works out about the same. So the retail markup is typically around £1.20. That leaves 44p to make that £4 bottle of wine. If you ever do the numbers on a £3 bottle of wine, you'll see that there's actually no money left to make that bottle of wine. Now, if we do a similar set of numbers on, say, a £5 bottle of wine, duty and VAT is £2.34, shipping is still 20p, retail markup is now £1.50, 30% markup, and that leaves the winemaker 96 pence to make that bottle of wine. Surprisingly, over double just for an extra pound spent on the wine. That's why I think from £5 upwards is a good price point to buy wine at. If you look now at, say, a £20 bottle of wine, the duty and VAT is £4.96. The shipping cost is still 20p. The retail markup is around £6, leaving the winemaker £8.84 to make that bottle of wine. That's a fairly good margin. I've actually put a table up, and if you go to wine pricing under on the left-hand side of the UK Wine Show, you'll see the grid for a range of different prices. But let's have a look now. On a £4 bottle of wine, the winemaker has 44p to make that bottle of wine. That includes growing the grapes and making the bottle of wine. To produce wines at or below £4 a bottle, you need huge scale to be profitable, and it requires a total focus on cost and producing large volumes of very cheap grapes. At a retail price of £5 a bottle, the winemaker receives around 96p to make that bottle of wine. That's over twice the amount for a £4 bottle of wine. And at around £5, the grower can start to afford to manage the grapes in the vineyard to a higher standard. Generally, the fruit concentration is big improvements, and by growing fewer grapes on the vines, lower yield that is, you can usually taste this by the flavour lingering for a while after you've swallowed it. Between £7 and £12 a bottle, the wine concentration continues to improve, but more flavours start to appear, either through the use of, say, oak barrels, which putting a wine into an oak barrel adds about 50p to the cost of the bottle, and it also can impart toasty vanilla flavours, or perhaps the soil where the grapes are grown is a bit unusual, and maybe have some minerals that give the wine a unique flavour. Wines between £7 and £12 can benefit also from ageing and often develop more unusual flavours as they age. All these extra flavours are said to add complexity to the wine. Between about £12 and £20, you get greater complexity and concentration of flavours, but you're starting to get into the law of diminishing returns. That is, the more you spend, you're not getting a huge increase in quality. However, the wineries are usually very well funded, and as such, in poor years, they have the equipment to get the most out of the grapes. For example, top chateaus in Bordeaux may use reverse osmosis filters to remove some of the water and increase concentration of the fruit in wet years. They also have the option to handpick grapes and, giving careful handling, the ability to select only the best fruit. If poor weather comes up at critical times, they're also able to mechanically harvest in very short time. This means that the wine will be able to be of a consistently high standard. Between £20 and £25 are making over £10 profit a bottle. This is normally more than they need to spend on equipment and labour in producing the wines. Some areas where the hype of the wine has forced up land prices so much, this has led to the wine costing more. Champagne is a classic example, where the incredible cost of the land has pushed the cost of the grapes up that the champagne houses buy. The thing to remember is, when a winemaker starts making a bottle of wine, they have a target price for the wine in mind. They will then use the techniques that will allow them to get the best wine made at a profit. That ends this week's look at wine pricing. I have one more week looking at wine pricing, and this time we're talking about super expensive wines. And after that, we're going to be announcing the results of this week's poll, which, as you remember, is: which one of the following do you prefer to drink when going out? Still a sparkling wine, beer, cider, spirit-based drinks or alcohols, or others? Do have your say. You can go to ukwineshow.co.uk and click on the wine poll on the right-hand side. We announced the poll last week, and if you recall last week, we also spoke to Charles Metcalf and Mike Florence about the International Wine Challenge results. These are now out, as well as the International Wine Spirit Competition. But this week, we're going to be talking with Martin Folk, winemaker at Three Choirs. It's a timely start, with English Wine Week starting tomorrow on the 24th of May and going through to the 1st of June. We're going to be talking with Martin about Three Choirs, the 2007 vintage, and the difference between growing grapes on sand and chalk, as well as How do you grow Cabernet Sauvignon in the UK? Let's have a listen to what Martin has to say. Hi, I'm here with Martin Falk. You're the winemaker at Three Choirs. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, thanks. Yep.
Where's Three Choirs based?
Three Choirs are on the west side of England, sort of halfway between Bristol and Birmingham, yep. Fairly close to the Welsh border.
It's Gloucestershire, isn't it?
Gloucestershire. So we're situated in and amongst the around the Cotswolds, the Welsh Mountains, and the Malvern Hills. Nice little horseshoe.
Yeah, very scenic around there.
Very nice. Yes. Yeah. Very good.
I went out to visit you guys a year or so ago, and on the way out, there was loads of those traction engines, steam engines, come chattering around.
Yeah, there's a local the Much Markle steam rally is quite a famous rally, I believe.
Is that what it was?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, they're not very fast on the road.
No. They we have a slow pace of life out there. It's quite nice, away from the city.
How did you get into wine, Martin?
Well, I initially qualified in agriculture and horticulture at Cirencester, and my intention was to go into farming. And I got the opportunity to work at the vineyard, and really things grew from there. I then went away and did a fair bit of work in Australia, and came back here and took over the winemaking at Three Choirs.
What year was that?
1988.
Oh, so you've been doing this for quite a while now.
I've been around a while, yes. Yep. It's and every vintage is different. There's a different challenge every year. And, I thoroughly enjoy it.
What's your best vintage so far? Or what's one that's been most exciting?
Oh, well, we've had excitement for different reasons. Oh, we've had very big vintages where the excitement's all been about where on earth are we going to put the juice once we've got it out of the grapes because we've run out of tanks. And we've had other vintages where the quality has been so fantastic that you just sort of revel in wines almost making themselves in the tanks. And 2007 is probably the best so far for me in that sense.
We'll touch on 2007 later on. But tell me a wee bit about Three Choirs, about your vineyard siting.
Well, we're...
Are you wet?
No, we're pretty dry, really. We've got these... surrounded by these hills that take most of the rainfall. We've got very sandy soil as well. We're sort of in the Severn Vale, really. And it's a very well-known area for top fruit growing. So there's a lot of strawberries, raspberries, black currants, a lot of apples. And so we knew when the vines were first planted there that it was going to be a good fruit area. The very good drainage that we get from the sandy soils helps. And I believe that sandy soils also give you a little bit more fruity character in wines. And I think that whilst we might miss out a little bit on the steely backbone that some people get off chalky soils, we do get this nice aromatic style of wine.
When you say steely backbone, is it more of a acidity-based type thing?
I don't think it is quite acidity. I think that it is... it's almost a slight flinty earthiness that you get in wines that are grown on chalkier soils. Sandy soils, to me, just seem to give rounder fruit, but a little bit softer. But it's not actually directly acidity. It's just this slightly aromatic style that seems to suit our soils.
Okay, does that mean that you're not really focusing in on the sparkling wine? Because you guys do a couple of different sparkling wines.
Yeah, we do produce sparkling. We've been great fans of Sauvignon Blanc for sparkling wine. And we've watched others come along and produce Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays that have been fantastic. And, it's been brilliant for the industry that people like Knight Timber and Ridgeview have gone out and taken the world on in the sparkling wine market. I don't have the confidence that our site is quite right for that. I must confess I'm also a little bit worried that there could be a little bit of overkill, and there's quite a lot of people who are starting to pursue that style of wine. So we're very happy just to sit back and let that happen and concentrate on what we feel we're good at.
Which is this
aromatic style from varieties like Sigaraba, Bacchus we have a lot of success with. And so that's really our plan for the future.
See, Sigaraba is a grape variety I've seen in blends, and I've tried in blends, but I've never had it by itself as 100%. Do you guys produce 100% Sigaraba?
We do. We do quite a lot of single varieties, which we sell mostly directly from the shop and mail order because they're in such small quantities. But Sigaraba as a single variety is very interesting. It's got a very, very short ripening period. So the time from flowering through to veraison is about 65 days, whereas you talk about Chardonnays and such like being 90 days plus. So it suits our climate very well. Produces a very ripe grape quite early in September. So we've got ripe grape with low acidity, lots of aromatic qualities. People talk about lychee and grapefruit and such like as being the style of the wine. And it's very nice to have something that's always fully ripe coming into the vineyard, into the winery. It doesn't always happen in England, but this variety always does.
Oh, okay. And have you considered blending it, or do you always...
Yeah, we do use it. We use it as a single variety and as a blend. It goes into a wine called Willowbrook. There's a wine called Variations Aromatic, which is also Segaraba-based. The problem this year, in 2007, is that out of all of the varieties that were hit badly, Segaraba was probably the worst. And there is very little of it about, I'm afraid, from 2007.
So tell us about 2007, because I know it was a problem vintage for a lot of people.
Yeah,
what was the story?
I think probably we were hit quite badly for two reasons. One was we had a very big crop in 2006, and the vine in general has a tendency to want to do big crop, little crop. So a lot of the management goes in to try and to iron that out. But the big crop in 2006, followed by this extremely wet weather we had in July, June, July, especially in Gloucestershire, actually caused a lot of the fruit to set very badly.
There was big floods, wasn't it?
Flooding. We had some quite dramatic times around us. Certainly Gloucester went underwater, and whilst we were a little bit higher, we were sort of looking down on it. But
my data centre went underwater with my servers a kit.
Yeah, it wasn't funny, and there's still a lot of people in the area who are still waiting to move back into their houses. So it was a fairly traumatic time.
Yeah.
But the vines looked like they'd set. But it was only really once we had hit the end of July and August, the flowers aborted, and the crop we could see was very small. The grapes themselves didn't actually make huge size either. But what we did get was a couple of weeks of quite nice sunshine at the end of August going into September. And being a small crop, it ripened fantastically. And the weight of the wine that we've got in bottle from 2007 is something we've never really seen before.
When you say weight, do you mean in terms
just,
of...
Just the characteristic, the flavour and the body in the wine is it's a lot more intense than the 06 vintage. Sure. But unfortunately, there's very little of it. So from Three Choirs' point of view, most of it is going to be sold through the local shop and through mail order. But there will be a bit about.
I'll make sure I have to try some of it. Get the odd bottle here and there and give it a good whirl. Do you think that because of, you know, you said boom-bust cycles every year or so, do you think that means that the 2008 crop could be quite a big one? All things being...
There's two ways of thinking about it. You can be an optimist and say yes, because you can never get two crops as small as 2007 in a row. I remember the previous smallest crops we've had were probably 1995, which was followed by a very big crop in 96. Followed by a small crop in 97, and since then we've been pretty even, really. So from that point of view, you can be fairly optimistic and say, yeah, that really ought to be a pretty good crop this year. From a pessimistic point of view, you could say, well, a lot of the potential for the following year is set in July, during the flower set, and because that weather wasn't particularly good, maybe there isn't going to be an enormous crop there. But normally with English vineyards, there's plenty of bud, plenty of potential, and we actually go through the vineyards after flowering, pulling stuff out normally.
Yes. I was going to ask, do you do a green harvest?
So you know the misconception is really that English vineyards struggle to produce enough, but in fact it's actually controlling your crop to produce the right amount to ripen it properly that's the challenge. Yeah. So. There's no reason to believe that there isn't going to be a good 2008 harvest.
It's always hard, though, isn't it? Because you've got to sort of second guess what the second half of the summer is going to be like for the ripening before, so you can work out how much fruit to pull so that you know it's
all
going to ripen.
Yeah, it is. And the earlier you do this, the better. And if you leave it too late, then the benefit that you get is very little. So you do have to be quite bold and actually just after flowering go and pull some stuff off.
Why do you think vines do this boom-bust type thing? Is it because you haven't been doing enough green harvesting in the big years, or is it just a function that the plant likes to store sugars in the roots, or what's going on there?
Well, I think it's very difficult to equate the way the vine behaves totally with the crop. because a lot of the variation in yields comes through the rainfall that happens in the summer. And we get a little bit more rainfall than most of our continental friends. And certainly I remember 1996 being a huge crop that virtually doubled in size on the vine in late August. So it was nothing to do with how the vine had actually produced. It was just the sheer size of the grape.
They just swelled.
They swelled so much. And you do get quite big variation in grape size from vintage to vintage.
That's not a good sign for quality, though, isn't it? If the grape's sucked up a load of water, you're going to lose sugar concentration, flavor concentration.
The whole thing becomes diluted, so it's certainly not a good thing.
Yeah.
But it is a very difficult thing to control, because no matter how many grapes you have, they will swell if the rain comes at the wrong time.
You've got sandy soils, and if I remember rightly, you're mainly on a hill, aren't you?
Yeah. Drainage is very good. The water runs away pretty well. And we do actually compensate by giving the vine a fair bit of competition. We leave grass in between the rows, keep that mowed off, and we actually, as the vine gets older and gets more vigorous, we actually cut out every other vine in the vineyard to actually make the ones that are left work harder. So there are all sorts of ways to try and combat it. But at the end of the day, if the weather really does go against you, I'm afraid that is a problem. It does happen.
I heard a rumour, and I don't know if it's a rumour or true or not. I thought you guys were growing some grapes under polytunnels or glass.
Rumours that get about, aren't there?
Yeah.
Yes, we're doing a small experiment. We've put up some tunnels that are removable, so they're not permanent structures.
Yep.
But we've planted some Cabernet Sauvignon and some Merlot, and the idea is that at key times of the year, when they need a little bit of help, either for flowering time or right at the end of the season, we can pull the polythene over the tunnels and actually give them that little bit of help. There's people that are doing it over here already. Beanley are very very well known for their success with Cabernet Sauvignon.
Who's this?
Beanley are down in Devon. Very small vineyard that has produced some exceedingly good quality and created quite a bit of interest in the past. So we thought that it was just a nice little thing to try.
How many vines are you growing? Two?
No. You actually increase the planting density. We've gone down the classic claret route, really, of planting high density, very few buds per vine, and trying to get maximum quality from it. But it's only an acre or so, so it'll never be a wilt breaker, but it's interesting.
Have you got crops off there yet?
No. Well, we should have had one last year, but because the season was so awful, it really wasn't enough to do anything with, so we didn't pick it. So this next harvest will be the first proper harvest that we get.
2008 Cabernet
Sauvignon. 2008 Cabernet Sauvignon.
Are you going to do it as a Cabernet Sauvignon, or are you going to blend it?
I've got to work out the legislation at the moment, because that's all changing. I think, hopefully.
It's not an approved grape variety, is it?
Not at the moment, no.
No?
No. We probably shouldn't be talking too much about it, I suppose. But it's I'm confident that the laws are changing at the moment. There's a lot of things changing in the legislation field, so I'm sure that there's a way around it. And as I say, it's going to be such small volume that it's not really going to be too much of an issue if we just bottle it up and drink it ourselves.
Make sure you send me a bottle.
I certainly will.
I'm definitely keen to try that. Why did you try that? That's quite an interesting idea, isn't it, the polytunnel concept? And did you get any hostility? Because I know some people around in the countryside aren't keen on polytunnels because of the environmental look.
Yeah, it is a contentious issue. There's an awful, you can understand that being in the area we're in with a lot of fruit going on, that there is a lot of people who are have got tunnels up for different reasons. Neighbours don't like it, without a doubt. But I think you have to be sympathetic and do it in the right way and not do it right next to people's houses. It is only an acre, and it's not whilst the metal structures are permanent, they can still come out. The polythene isn't actually on for that long, so it's not too much of an eyesore, really.
I've heard polytunnels where you chuck it out after a season.
No, this is these go from season to season. You just roll them up and keep them at the sides. Eventually, they'll become too brittle and they'll break up, but they will do quite a few vintages.
And do you think it's going to be economically viable, or is this more of a bit of fun for you?
I'm sure it's not at all viable economically. Even if we were to be able to charge £25-30 a bottle, it's not going to be something that makes us want to put the whole vineyard under polythene. It is purely a just a little bit of fun, really, and a way of producing something different. Because we do have a lot of people that stay at the vineyard, a lot of people eat in the restaurant.
I was going to say, you've got accommodation on site, yeah. You've got a restaurant on site. Do people use you as a function activity, you know, if you do corporate away days, or who comes to visit you guys?
Most of the people that come are coming on weekend breaks, they're people that haven't got the time necessarily to go abroad, want to stay in a vineyard. They can stay in the rooms and sit in their rooms and look out over the vineyard, and when the sun comes out, sit in the restaurant out on the balcony and feel like they're in a different country. It's, it is a very nice setting. It is more of that market than it is the corporate market, because one of the things we don't do is we won't shut down our restaurant for a private function such as a wedding or corporate, because the locals are missing out, and the locals have become quite an important part. And it's quite interesting, when I first got involved with Three Choirs, we were very much a tourist venue, and we were quite profitable between the months of May through till September. Had a lot of coach parties came out, and it was quite a thriving business, but it was absolutely dead between sort of October right the way through till April. And so to run a business on an annual basis profitably was very difficult. But none of the locals ever came to see us. And now the restaurant is a local venue. So we have a new clientele, if you like.
Yep.
And they're very important to us right the way through the year. We don't have the space for function rooms as such. We do smallish events for sort of anything up to sort of 16, 20 people we can cope with. And we can do a very bespoke, good job for them. But the large corporate sort of market is not what we're aiming for at the moment.
Okay, well, that's fantastic, Martin. How hard is it to find you guys?
It's pretty easy, really. If you can get yourself to Gloucester, then...
You're not on a railway or anything like that?
No, we're quite away. We're about 12 miles outside of Gloucester. So, really, by car is the only sensible way to find us.
Yeah.
There is a Ledbury, there's a train station there, but it would be a taxi ride in. So sensibly, it's a car or a minibus or a coach or whatever.
Okay, excellent, Martin. Thank you very much for your time.
That's okay.
Cheers, mate. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Martin. I don't think glasshouse wines are ever going to be an economically viable, but it does make for an interesting proposition. After the interview, I tracked down the Cabernet Sauvignon that he recommended, and sure, it was okay, but it was certainly nowhere near as good as an average Bordeaux or a Coonawarra Cabernet Sauvignon from Australia. Next week, though, we're going to be back talking with the International Wine Challenge, and in particular, we're going to be starting a three-part series looking at wine faults. I spent a second day at the International Wine Challenge with Sam Harrop, MW and winemaker, and he's also an expert on all things wrong with wine. These are some fairly technical shows, but based on some of the feedback I'm getting from you guys, you like them that way. But, as always, just to finish off with a wee joke, so here's this week's joke. Sally was driving home from a business trip in northern Arizona when she saw an elderly Navajo woman walking on the side of the road. As the trip was a long and quiet one, she stopped the car and asked the Navajo woman if she'd like a ride. With a silent nod of thanks, the woman got into the car. Resuming the journey, Sally tried in vain to make a bit of small talk with the Navajo woman. The old woman just sat silently, looking intently at everything she saw, studying every little detail, until she noticed a brown bag on the seat next to Sally. "What's in the bag?" asked the old woman. Sally looked down at the brown bag and said, "Oh, it's a bottle of wine I got for my husband." The Navajo woman was silent for another moment or two. Then, speaking with the quiet wisdom of an elder, she said, "Good trade." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.